Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 3:40 PM. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 25th, today being Friday. It's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off today thinking about the outlook for cryptocurrencies, fintech more generally, innovation, and then thinking about inflation as well. And I think we'll see where we go. But I thought we'd kick off, to begin with at least, with Riot Blockchain, because the company used to be called Aspen Biopharma, then it was Venaxis, then it was Bio or Bioptic, and now it's Riot Blockchain. And I thought it was relevant to just look at how have shareholders done from owning this company that has been indecisive in how they thought they might be able to make money. So back in the distant past of 2007, there was a lot of money in speculative ventures, and they did really very well. The share traded out to, and of course there have been multiple occasions when the stock has split and reverse split and consolidated since then, but the equivalent of $3,500. So maybe they weren't involved in Bitcoin back then, and it was also a speculative venture. There's nothing to say that you can't just speculate in biotechnology. It's one of those kinds of sectors where you can make big promises, and then you go up for clinical trials, and then your big promise either succeeds or fails. And more often than not, they fail. And then you don't get a lot of investigation into just how much fraud had gone on in order to get to that point of a clinical trial. But you do get a lot of money chasing them because there is an end point. And if a therapy, treatment, or a medical procedure, or a diagnostic piece of equipment can be proven to work, well, then the rewards are astounding. So then there are investors every step of the way along the biotechnology sector, and they can help to inflate prices to very extravagant levels. But we can also look at what happens, and obviously the trend changed completely after 2012. And then it was around 2017 they changed their name to Riot Blockchain. So that reinvigorated the share, and it went from 3 to about 50. So that was a big move. And this time around, we had a bigger move in Bitcoin, so we had a bigger move in the share. And subsequently, it fell much more than Bitcoin, going from 80 down to 20. Now it's still steady. And Riot Blockchain is out there, and they're trying to buy up as many mining rigs as they can. China has banned all forms of cryptocurrency mining. And that's a whole topic all on its own. But the net effect is that Bitmain, which is one of the primary suppliers of mining rigs, has stopped selling into the retail market. And they are trying to support the market by giving opportunity to the domestic mining sector in China to offload their machinery. And Riot Blockchain is in there trying to buy them. One of the idiosyncrasies of Bitcoin is that there is only a certain number are going to be issued on any given day. And then the difficulty of solving the riddle is, and or the mathematical equation gets either more difficult or easier depending on how many computers are attempting to solve it. So that's when people talk about the hash rate, that's what it means. It's the strength of the network, how much activity is in the network to try and solve this riddle. Well, the more rigs you have, the greater the potential is that you're going to solve it, but that's only true in respect of the total number of rigs trying to solve it. So if you can gain market share and have a greater percentage of the available mining rigs, well, then you have a better chance of making more money. So even in a declining price environment, if you can have more of the mining rigs, well, then you might at least be able to garner some additional interest. It is interesting what's been happening in Bitcoin this week, because every time it's got down to test at that $30,000 area, it's bounced. And it did that again on Tuesday, and it did rebound. So there was the potential until today that it was going to go back up and test that 40,000 level. But we didn't have a big pop on the upside today, so it's at a new closing low. Now, it has not broken below the 30,000 level, so we might yet see some volatile trading over the weekend. And Bitcoin does trade in a volatile manner over the weekend, and it's not the first time that we've seen a big pullback on a Friday. And people do tend to liquidate their positions because they're worried about having stops triggered over the weekend period. So what happens in the next couple of days will be instructive. It's probably going to be a rather interesting weekend for Bitcoin. If it falls through 30,000, well, then all those retail investors that bought, and a good share of the institutional investors that bought in January, they're all definitely going to be in a losing position. And that changes people's perspective, because once you're sitting on a loss, well, then it's harder to buy more. So there's then also going to be this the incentive to sell. So I think that's one of the important points. Then, of course, what we've also seen, and it was I think the only way to describe it is quite predictable, is that Ethereum is let's just put some dates on it. Bitcoin peaked in April, so the date was effectively April 14th, and Ethereum peaked about 3 weeks after Bitcoin did in 2018. Bitcoin peaked in December, and then Ethereum peaked about a month later. So the peak in Ethereum was almost exactly 1 month later. I think maybe 4 weeks this time, 3 weeks last time. And since then, it's fallen more. So the peak was around the $4,380 level, and it's trading at $1,800 right now. So this is more than 50% decline, and it has got more of a technical deterioration than Bitcoin does, because it is now trading below that psychological 2,000 level. Now, it's right in the region of the simple moving average. But the most important thing is that this still looks like a downtrend, and we don't have evidence that more than a short-term low has been found. And one thing I thought was interesting, I don't have Bloomberg doesn't have charts for Dogecoin, but it has steadied over the course of the last couple of days. I would opine, though, that if Bitcoin remains weak, there's just no way that the altcoins are going to hold up. So we're certainly in a corrective phase overall. And the other one that tends to, and I think it's interesting that people, they tend to have historically talked about, it's either Argentina or Brazil, that it has enormous potential and always will. Well, if IOTA is the other big project that tends to attract attention, but it has not been able to, or it's also referred to as the project that has a lot of potential, but always will do. So we're still in this corrective phase overall. I think it's worth considering why people think about the cryptocurrency markets and associated with financial technology. The one most important point is that we've had companies like Tencent and Alibaba lead the way in terms of financial innovation. But The most important thing is that they were able to reach the success that they did, and they were able to just accumulate massive deposits because they were able to circumvent banking regulation. And they were allowed to do that by the Chinese government without recourse to the cryptocurrency markets. So they were able to do it because China looked the other way. China wanted to have a domestic technology sector, and they picked their champions and they let those companies do basically whatever they wanted. And they just let them compete and to really take business from the established financial sector with really no comeuppance. And there was no real effort to regulate them. And now that's changing. So certainly we had the success of Tencent and the success of Alipay, and just the experience of using those apps in China is probably something that encouraged the Chinese government to then adopt its own version of cryptocurrency, and or which is perhaps more accurate to call a digital currency. There's obviously going to be security measures, which might be referred to as cryptographic for China. But the notion that it will be anonymous or independent when China deploys their digital currency, well, that's just completely unrealistic. When one uses WeChat Pay or Alipay in China, it's incredibly seamless. So when you are on an app like or you're on our Meituan's app, it's incredibly easy to use, and it shepherds you towards deals, and it helps you to get reservations faster. And the more that you engage with the app, the more you're rewarded. And then it ensures that you can use your phone for all manner of payments. And the physical payments and online payments are completely seamless. So it really doesn't feel like you're engaging in anything different. And you don't have to carry a credit card or a wallet around any longer. In fact, if you want to pay for anything with cash, it's just not possible. So looking at that seamless way of effecting transactions in the economy, the Chinese Communist Party thought, well, golly, that sounds really great. And it offers incredible transparency into the machinations of the economy. The challenge with cash is that the government never really knows where the money goes. They can look at retail sales, and they can look at bank deposits, and there's a lot of leakage in between. So we don't really know, where does somebody go off and spend their money? What do they buy when they are, what do individuals buy? Obviously, we know if a company reports how many sales they have, everybody can look that up and say they've sold so many washing machines or so many TVs, but we don't know what individuals are buying. Well, with the introduction of a digital currency, then the government will have absolute transparency into what people are buying. One of the really, from a government perspective, attractive qualities of online payments is that the books of corporations and companies are completely transparent. There are no more cash sales, so there is no way to under-report earnings. So this is incredibly attractive from the perspective of governments. And they're going to deploy a new digital currency in China with the clear intention that they're going to use that data in order to better manage the economy. And of course, from their definition of managing the economy, what that also means is that they're going to clamp down on any form of dissent, however that might be defined. Now, everyone else in the world is looking at the model that originated with Alipay and WeChat and thinking, gee, that they were really successful. And they also want to mirror that kind of innovation. But we have to come back to the question of how did they succeed in the first place? And it was by circumventing banking regulation. So there's a business mo there are a couple of different ways that technological innovation succeeds. The first is you come up with a brand new product. So a brand new product would be something in the order of social media. Social media didn't exist before to any great extent. It evolved out of email and the online message boards. And then we had this additional innovation. So it didn't exactly come out of nowhere, but it certainly progressed. And we had this explosive growth. And it didn't break rules in order to get there, because people willingly gave up their personal information. Then you have the other kind of the similar kind of innovation would be Apple in the creation of the iPhone. They were able to bring an iterative product to the market that was completely different to anything else that was on the market at the time. They accumulated massive interest in it and didn't have to break rules along the way to do so. That's one way of doing it, that you get new companies that come out of nowhere with a brand new product and they change the world by producing something that's completely new. Well, there have been a crop of companies during this bull market who have looked at established businesses and decided they were going to simply ignore the rules. And that flouting of the law has been a primary characteristic of some of the most successful companies. So on the one hand, we had companies like Meituan and Alibaba that were allowed to circumvent banking rules. And now that they have grown enough and that they pose a threat to the ability of the Communist Party to manage the economy and to assert their authority, they're being brought to heel. And the way that they're being brought to heel is that they're being forced to abide by conventional banking rules. The primary reason that companies are adopting cryptocurrencies for solutions. And when we look at all of the rationales, why does Novo Nordisk need to use a blockchain to track its shipping containers from the origin port to the end port? Why would we need a cryptocurrency for social media? Well, all of these types of arguments, to me, they've all been rather circular. I've been struggling for a while to figure out what exactly is the primary rationale for all of these arguments for why you have to use a cryptocurrency when no one's ever really had to use one before. And of course, the answer is simple. They're unregulated. So if you have a business model that depends entirely upon breaking rules and ensuring that you gain critical mass faster than rules can change, so that then you can deliver a fait accompli to regulators and therefore influence the decision about future regulation. Well, if that's your business model, then adopting cryptocurrencies in the financial sector and anything to do with finance, whether it's e-commerce, lending, contracts, well, all of those are challenging existing laws and norms. And that's why those types of projects are adopting cryptocurrency characteristics, because they're unregulated. It's basically the solution that's being deployed to avoid regulation. Well, Uber, for example, did exactly that, and in many respects, they have succeeded because of their popularity. So, the share was one of the largest IPOs, and it is still holding on there, and it's consolidating above its IPO price, which is generally a rather positive signal overall. And the one of the, I think, important points is that they have cash on their balance sheet. I'm just looking for it now in their main balance sheet. There we go. So they still have about $5.6 billion sitting in cash, and that has held pretty steady. The enterprise value of the company really hasn't moved in the course of the last year, and it, of course, doubled in 2019. But the bigger picture here is that they're not about to run out of money anytime soon, and particularly that, well, I guess when we say anytime soon, they've got a runway of about 18 months because the free cash flow is negative at about 3.3 billion. So they still have a while to try and figure out how they can raise money. But their entire success was built on breaking the rules. And they decimated the taxi service, and many of those people had invested their life savings in buying taxi medallions, and they've been completely wiped out. And now Uber is looking at raising prices. So it is really, in many respects, piracy. It's exactly the same kind of activity that Amazon and the other big retailers are often accused of, that they go in they with low prices, and then when they have achieved their goal of knocking out the competition, they raise prices. Well, Amazon is now right in the region of the upper side of its range, and it's been pausing now over the last 2 days. So I think it's important that we did have another rebound from the region of the trend mean. And now the question is, will that trend mean continue to hold? Whenever we get these lengthier processes of consolidation, it does beg the question whether it's top formation development or whether it's just another one of these ranges, because Amazon has had plenty of them. And there have been plenty of times when it has just gone sideways, and gone sideways for lengthy periods of time. But the important point is that it has tended to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So, in order to really confirm that this bull trend is over, well, Amazon would need to sustain a move below the 3,000 level. And that's about 15% from where the price is right now. And for a share that went from 6 to 3,400, then a 15% pullback is not all that much. Well, obviously there are big questions that are going around right now, but about the outlook for growth, and particularly relative to value, and the outlook for interest rates and inflation. But I would like to spend just a little bit more time considering innovation, because we also have Airbnb, and again, this is another company that has been able to force its way into the global economy by flouting rules. And the share hasn't really gone much of anywhere since the IPO. So it hasn't been one of the really big success stories beyond the first day. And it's still pausing because there are two big issues with Airbnb. The first is that the legality of moving into various cities, and whether it's legal in places like New York or the high traffic cities around the world to just hoover up short apartments for short-term rentals. So that's obviously a challenge. But then there's the quality issue, because especially once you get out of the well-governed countries and you go into the rest of the world, then governance starts to really play an important role. Because I certainly know that we stopped using Airbnb because we had some good experiences when we came to the USA. We had some terrible experiences when we went to France, or to the south of France, where there has habitually been a lot of competition for rentals. And then in China, when we walked into the door in an extremely upmarket area of Guangzhou, there were cockroaches on the floor, and that was a no-go for us. So that's an additional challenge for companies like this, that the sharing economy is very dependent on good governance, but not only good governance from the company itself, but also from everyone else who engages in it. And the policing, the ability to police it is very suspect. So then the question is, how are they going to deal with these kinds of challenges? Having forced their way into the global economy, then the chances are that Airbnb is just going to eventually turn into another broker. And it's interesting that Expedia is doing better. So Expedia has rebounded in emphatic fashion over the course of this year, and it's continuing to hold the breakout above that 2017 peak. And of course, it's doesn't make really it's an innovator in its own right, but it didn't have to break any rules to do it. And it's still one of the go-to places for people to book hotels and flights and all manner of other services. So the move fast and break things model has been obviously epitomized by Tesla. So Tesla is now right in the region of the trend mean, and it did firm this week, but it was weaker in here today. It's a company that is extraordinarily dependent on liquidity. So Tesla was able to move fast because they benefited from regulatory arbitrage. And then they were able to flout laws like keeping their factory open when they were ordered to close during the pandemic, and running with something that they call autopilot when it is not an autopilot. So these are the kinds of things that would other companies wouldn't be able to come back from, and yet Tesla has successfully been able to implicate itself into the global automotive sector, and it has been able to benefit from changes in regulation so that they were able to completely monopolize the sale of carbon credits. That basically allowed them to go build their factories with money they got from their competitors. And this kind of situation, where companies are forced to fund the growth of their competitors, is completely impossible without governments getting in the way. So regulatory arbitrage is another way to grow quickly. So then we have those three. We have the move fast and break the rules. We have the regulatory arbitrage, and then we have what most people consider to be the way that technology evolves, is that you come up with a brand new product. Well, I think when we think about the brand new product element, it's worth reminding ourselves that the first human genome was sequenced less than 20 years ago. And in that time, the pace of innovation in genetics has accelerated much faster than Moore's Law. So the speed with which the cost of sequencing DNA has compressed, then that has gone exponentially faster than Moore's Law. It's gone from hundreds of thousands of dollars to less than $1,000. So that's a profound change. 23andMe IPO'd just this week, and they are looking at attempting at least to take the data that they get and that people pay them to take, and then using that to go off and develop novel solutions to problems. Now, there are a couple of different issues with genetics and the biotech sector generally. The first is that genetic solutions can be cures, and pharmaceuticals don't trade in cures. They trade in treatments to chronic conditions. That's why diabetes is such a money spinner, because there's no cure. And then people really just try and manage their symptoms. And by managing their symptoms, then they commit to a long-term cash flow. So that's wonderful news for pharmaceutical companies. They come away with an extremely profitable product line with a growing number of clients, and it works out really well in terms of profitability. But genetics and genetic solutions to problems, well, they have the potential to deliver cures. And the big question for the sector overall is, how do you price a cure? If we had a pill or an injection that would cure diabetes, and one diabetic patient who has insurance or is covered by a national program, they might represent a cash flow of several hundred thousand dollars over their lifetime. Well, and then of course there is the additional cash flow for surgery and for various other treatments as the illness progresses. And then if there were a solution to that, and it could be in the form of a pill or an injection, well, how do you price that? Do you present value the long-term cash flows, which would be an extraordinary sum? Or do you price it and try and sell as many of them as you can for as long as you can? Or do you force whoever is taking it to pay for the cost of innovation and then contribute to a fund that will provide an annuity to the developer over time? Well, none of these solutions have been tried out, because we're not quite there yet in the development of genetic solutions. But one thing is for sure, and it's that companies like Spark Therapeutics have been bought out. So we're certainly seeing that they were bought by Roche. And one thing that I think is interesting is that the CEO of Roche was in here today talking about the fact that he thinks that mRNA technology is going to be a game changer for cancer therapy. So he's thinking, and this is why a lot of genetic solutions are being deployed in oncology. The immuno-oncology sector had a real big bull market move about 3 or 4 years ago, and subsequently most of those shares collapsed. But the big picture here is that immuno-oncology is where we get the clearest evidence of customized medicine, because every individual tumor is unique. So they all need these unique solutions. So therefore, you can create a cure, but it's an individual cure, and there's just no way that these companies can get their money back from developing individual cures for individual people. What they need is a homogenized solution, and they just don't have one. So we definitely see that these types of companies, they initially show a lot of promise, but when they deploy in immuno-oncology, then they don't tend to have staying power. Now, we're going to get the occasional flurry on the upside. And we saw that, for example, with Clovis Oncology. They popped on the upside at the end of 2019 and then came all the way back down again. And arguably, it is starting to firm once more. And because you're talking about the cure for cancer, then copywriters love that. And in the healthcare sector, when unfortunately, it's the default prospect. How do you try to sell somebody something in healthcare? You tell them it's going to cure cancer. So these companies are potentially going to have another flurry of activity in much the same way that a lot of the SPACs and a lot of the retail favorites and the meme stocks. There's a large number of these types of small biotech companies are in that meme stock type of, they like to look for these long base formations, and they like to look where there's no activity so that a small amount of money can have an outsized move. And when you look at the market cap of some of these companies, it's small. So only 683 million. I was looking at Organovo today, and Organovo is one of these exciting companies. And when you look at what they do and what the potential is, it's extremely exciting. So if we just look at those three types of innovation, whether it is regulatory innovation or breaking the rules innovation or new technology, well, it definitely falls into the final category. But it's a great example of how difficult that is, because they have come up with a way of printing genetic material, and they can produce skin cells or liver cells, and then they sell those to biological research areas, and then they don't have to look at it's living tissue, so they get to experiment on it, and it helps to speed up the pace of innovation overall. But the problem is, it's a small market, and despite the fact that they can literally print organs, they can print genetic material, at least in small sizes, it's just not attracting interest, because the size of the market they're attempting to target is comparatively small, and there's no real impetus behind it. And then there's the practice of the company is that they've never had positive earnings, and they issue new shares every 2 or 3 years, and they replenish their money, and then they go off and keep developing their technology, but they're not in any great hurry. So it's an incredibly promising sector, and one thing that we certainly have is a lot of competition in these kinds of sectors, because there's so much excitement about what the potential is. So when we think about what the potential is, well, there has been a lot of talk about what's going on in Singapore in terms of printing, or the bioprinting and bioreactors, and using them to create chicken fillets from the raw materials without ever slaughtering an animal. And the first factory is about to open in Israel. So they are looking at producing the about 250 chickens worth of meat every day. So it's a proof of concept. Now, they need a room, and which is extremely large, and these bioreactors are quite large. But eventually, and they say that they can do it relatively economically. So it does increase the potential that the kinds of technologies that were pioneered by one company will inspire others to come up and pick up the baton and then bring something to commercial use. And that does appear to be what's happening with Organovo. So it's likely that these companies coming out of Singapore and Israel, who are both significant protein importers, well, they're going to pioneer these kinds of solutions. Of course, there's going to be a very significant lobby against the lab-created or lab-grown proteins from places like North America and Europe, where there are very sizable farming communities. But there are two big innovations in agriculture. The first is vertical farms, and the second is lab-grown meats. Well, the one interesting thing about vertical farms is that we need to find use cases for all the malls that have been vacated and all the retail locations that are just not fit for purpose any longer. So some plans are that those will be turned into housing, but there's the additional potential that if the price were low enough, that they could be turned into farms. And the nice thing about farms and vertical farms is the absence of pesticides, the absence of insects. So then that greatly helps to improve the profitability of the operations. It reduces the time and transportation, so it creates a local food source. And if that can be made economic, well, then that's an additional aid for the health of cities. And then we have the prospect of lab-grown meat. Well, eventually the size of those bioreactors will decrease, and then it will be possible for consumers to have an additional piece of or just an appliance at home that will allow them to print whatever protein they wish. So it suggests that there is a real future for this kind of technology. And it's companies that have got histories in producing bioreactors, they might be some of the better performers. And there's also those like Danaher, which has history in producing bioreactors and then also deploys a private equity-like business model to acquire new technologies that is likely to continue to do well. Thermo Fisher did exceptionally well in early 2020, and it's been going sideways for most of the last 6 to 7 months. So now it's right in the region of the upper side of that range. So we can definitely see that there's lots of innovation. But there is a fourth strut to innovation, and that's funding. You can have a wonderful idea, and you can think that you might be able to circumvent some of the rules and bend some rules and break others and ignore others in order to get your company off the ground. But the pace of innovation has accelerated exceptionally over the course of the last 40 years. And that's been particularly true because interest rates have been trending down. So whenever interest rates start to pop back up, then it puts pressure on growth. Because there are lots of companies that don't have any earnings, and they can survive pretty much indefinitely. That's why I had put up Semiconductor Technologies earlier. This is a company that has been printing new shares practically on an annual basis for decades. And relative to how many shares they've printed, it traded at over $14 million back in 1999. Well, what's, I think, perhaps really difficult for investors is that they did invent a superconductor. So those types of superconductors that they've invented are being deployed in a lot of the fusion experiments that are taking place right now. And one of the reasons that you can get these modular designs for fusion reactors, they, of course, none of them have generated net positive energy yet. But One of the reasons, and the primary reason why they can be smaller is because of the room temperature superconductors. And that has allowed that magnetic fields can be so much stronger and don't require magnets, that they can use superconductors to create these extraordinarily powerful magnetic fields to contain the plasma. And that kind of innovation has been sitting around with no use case for years. And this company has been going back to the market year after year, and they will occasionally get a grant from the government to ensure they don't go bust and that they can continue to develop their technology. But they have been woefully unsuccessful at commercializing it. And in the meantime, others have taken up the kinds of innovation they've delivered and run with it and been much more successful. So there are superconductor companies in Japan and South Korea that have done substantially better overall. So it's not like every company that can innovate does, but certainly the ability to raise funding from low interest rates has helped to support the speculative market, and that has been true for decades. So it is particularly relevant that when we think about Amazon and Tesla and Netflix, that they tend to pop on the upside when interest rates or when yields compress, and then they tend to fall back down again when the bond yield rises. Perhaps the most important thing that I think many people have tended to forget because of the longevity of the bull market in technology is that historically technology has been viewed as cyclical. So the invention of the, and I guess we're going to see an example of that in the semiconductor sector. There's an acute shortage of semiconductors at present, and there is hundreds of billions being devoted to increasing supply. Well, when that supply comes online, then there's going to be an excess of supply, and a lot of those companies are going to run into trouble. So that's just a clear example of how cyclical markets work. And we know about cyclicality from the mining sector. So mining is also an extremely cyclical sector. When interest rates rise and bond yields become less accommodative, and then it's harder for companies to raise money, well, that is going to weigh on their ability to raise money, but it's also going to have an effect on their valuation. Because when money is free and they can get as much of it as they like, then they can push out the date to when they're going to have a net positive cash flow, and that helps to inflate their valuation. When you start reintroducing a discount rate, well, then that starts to shorten the horizon, and therefore it puts their valuation under pressure. So every time bond yields rise, then it puts pressure on unprofitable companies. Now, I think the most important thing that we've seen this week is that the 10-year yield bounced from the region of the trend mean. We've seen that the Biden administration is trying to push through their infrastructure bill, and it's not there yet, but it is increasingly likely that some kind of additional stimulative bill will be passed. We can also think about the quantity of money that was printed in 2020. Central bank balance sheets jumped by almost 10 trillion. So we're still in a benign environment. The Federal Reserve has clearly said they're not going to raise interest rates. And they're certainly not going to raise rates until they have ample evidence that inflationary pressures are trending higher and that unemployment has moderated. So unemployment moderating isn't going as quickly as anticipated, and inflationary pressures are starting to moderate. And if that's the case, well, then it means that the supply of money is going to persist. But it doesn't mean that investors have to conclude that that isn't going to eventually create inflation. Lumber prices were a limit down again today, so we've had another big decline and it is now pulling down through the 200-day moving average. Oil prices, on the other hand, remain quite steady, and again, this is an artificial scenario, so that is only possible because OPEC is withholding supply from the market and it will continue to rise until they stop. Semiconductor supply is beginning to ease somewhat, and I do have a chart from that. What we saw yesterday is that the lead times for chips is out to about 18 weeks, but other parts of the market are starting to ease, so that's particularly relevant for the automotive sector. So that's a source of inflation that will moderate. And then we can think about the agricultural commodity sector, where prices are also starting to moderate. And soybeans is now back below its trend mean on that front month contract. So some of the issues that people were worried about with regard to inflation in the short term are moderating, but investors are not buying bonds for two reasons. The first is that there is increasing supply. So governments are willing to run deficits, and the Federal Reserve is willing to fund those deficits. And it's not just the Federal Reserve, because the Bank of England this week it adopted the same transitory wordage or verbiage in their statement. And the ECB in here today was saying that, or the Christine Lagarde was saying that governments need to water the green shoots. And you have former head of the ECB, Mario Draghi, who's now in charge of Italy, saying that we need lots more fiscal stimulus. So bonds are selling off on the one hand because there's additional supply, and additionally because there are inflationary pressures, but perhaps not in the places where central banks are looking. So bond yields are pushing higher, and it is supporting the value argument. And most particularly, it should be supporting the industrial resources, but copper prices remain soft, and they have rebounded this week, and potentially that is support around the $4 area. But I'm a little bit reluctant to conclude that that is the low until we see a higher reaction low. And also, I think we're still at a point where we're going to try and depress these prices a little further. So that would suggest that we're in for some volatility in the copper price. All of that contributes to pushing out the date when central banks will, in fact, start to reduce stimulus. Of course, what that also supports is continued economic development and less need for a safe haven. So that's why bond yields are pushing on the upside. But it's also starting to take a toll on gold, and the price is just about holding on this week. It really hasn't gone anywhere. But the most important thing is there's been a distinct absence of upper dynamics. So gold is at that critical point where it's fallen back enough that investors are starting to get interested once more. And it's also been trending down for most of the last year. So obviously then people are starting to think, well, how long more is this going to continue? I think one of the most important things is that people just don't feel the urgency, that they feel like they can wait and see, because we haven't had conclusive evidence that inflation is taking over just yet. And until we start to see negative real interest rates really starting to affect how people make decisions, then we're not going to have a big pop on the upside. Nonetheless, inflation does look like it's baked in the cake because I think, and I do believe this is really very relevant, that central banks were worried about inflation. So they acted in a manner to try and curtail it. And the big change from the pandemic is that they're no longer worried about inflation. And they are willing to do whatever it takes to encourage it because they think that they can get it under control. But that might be hubristic. And it pretty much ensures that there will be an inflationary outcome because wages are rising, export prices and prices at the factory door in China are rising, and most particularly, the dollar having rebounded on Fed news last week is just about holding on. If the dollar eventually breaks down, which I believe is likely, and I think is perhaps better described as more, it's an inevitability, it's only a question of how long it takes, then that will be in response to more inflationary pressures. And it's likely that that will also be the linchpin in continued outsized, or I think a resumption of outsized demand for emerging markets and non-US assets. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.